Good morning. I call the Senate Finance Committee meeting to order. Today is Monday, February 10th, 2020, and the time is about 9:01 a.m. We are meeting at the Senate Finance Room in the State Capitol. Please silence your cell phones. This is Co-Chair Natasha von Imhoff, and I'm joined today by Co-Chair Senator Stedman, Senator Bishop, Senator Olson, Senator Wilikowski, and Senator Hoffman. Senator Wilson is excused today. We also have President Kathy Geisel with us. We do have a quorum to do business. Today's agenda, we have two bills, House Bill 139, the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation Procurement Exemption, and House Bill 68, Labor Standards Safety Workers' Compensation. Our first bill today is House Bill 139, Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation Procurement Exemption. It is an act providing an exemption from the House Procurement Code for the acquisition of investment-related services for assets managed by the Board of Trustees of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. I'd like to invite the sponsor, the bill sponsor, Representative Jennifer Johnson, to present the bill. So please identify yourself for the record and begin.
Good morning, Co-Chair Von Imhoff and Stedman. For the record, I'm Jennifer Johnston, representative for District 28. Thank you for hearing House Bill 139 this morning. Somebody suggested that you might not be able to see me sitting in this chair because it sits so low, but I think I'm here. House Bill 139 grants an additional exemption from the procurement code to the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. Current laws exempt the corporation from procurement code when it acquires income-producing assets or delegates an investment authority. However, they must comply with the state's procurement code when evaluating and managing the asset in which they invest. Currently, when the corporation is evaluating these types of investments, they need to hire third-party experts, and they must go through the procurement code to secure these experts, which can be cumbersome and can take 50 to 60 days. If the corporation doesn't have the time to adhere to the code, but think an investment is worthy, they will work with a fund manager to hire the experts, vet the instrument, and place the investment. When they take this approach, they pay a fund manager a fixed management fee, and they also give up a negotiated portion of the potential profit. The change proposed in this bill will allow a timeline that better aligns with the pace of the markets in which the corporation works, will result in a more streamlined process, and will potentially save the state money. I am available to answer questions, as well as my staff, Robert Irvin, and Angela Rodell, CEO of Permanent Fund Corporation, is also available.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Are there any questions regarding the intent of the bill? Okay. Oh, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Representative Johnston, if this is such a good idea, why hasn't it been presented before?
And I would like to answer your question. I mean, for me, it's as investments change, sure. And so it hasn't been as necessary in the past because we're invested in different assets. Mm-hmm. But if you'd like to hear from the CEO of the Permanent Fund, we could ask her up.
So we do have Ms. Rodell in the queue to speak and testify. Is there anybody that has any questions for the bill sponsor? Thank you, Representative Johnson. If we could actually have Ms. Angela Rodell come to the bench and speak to the bill, and please identify yourself for the record and let us know if the Permanent Fund Corporation supports this bill.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. For the record, my name is Angela Rodell. I'm the CEO of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. Procurement exemption is a change that the Permanent Fund Corporation has been trying to pursue since I took this job 4.5 years ago. And so to get to this point with this bill feels like a tremendous achievement already. We do support this bill and would encourage the support of this committee, the members of this committee, as well as the full Senate in passing this legislation.
Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. There's a 1993 Attorney General opinion that on this exact issue, which refused to exempt the Permanent Fund Corporation from the procurement requirements. That was in 1993, so we've gone 17 years with this. And as Senator Olson mentioned, it hasn't been changed. I guess what's the urgency right now? And let me just say this, that the purpose of the procurement laws are to prevent contracts to friends, political allies, supporters, paybacks, as well as hasty contracting decisions that could lead to negligent hiring of contractors. The Permanent Fund has done very well for decades with this on the books. Why do we need to change it now?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, it's been 27 years since that.
Thank you.
Attorney General opinion, and a lot has changed about the asset allocation of the fund. At that time, we were not in the private market space that we are in today. So that change came about. That ability to be a prudent investor was not on the books in 1993. It is now on the books and has been on the books since 2005. I think more importantly, what has changed more than anything else is the sheer responsibility that has been placed on our shoulders to deliver not only an amount for a dividend, but an amount that is substantial for the purpose of state government. And to the extent that we have that responsibility and we know that our success depends upon keeping and maintaining the trust of Alaskans. And so it's imperative that we use our procurement process through regulation like other agencies and maintain that trust in order to be successful and to deliver the returns that everyone has come to rely on.
Senator Wilikowski, follow up.
Yeah, thank you. And keeping the trust of Alaskans is exactly why you have the procurement code. So that so you don't have people who are hired who aren't qualified or maybe political supporters or things like that. But what is there no way to already clear experts in certain areas of need under the current 54-day RFP process per the state procurement code and then just utilize them as issues arise?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, oftentimes ideas come up. And so to have a long list of possible contracts that we could tap into doesn't seem feasible because we never know what type of experts. And these are experts that are not fiduciaries to the fund. They may be experts in terms of science, biotech, engineers, and have that type of expertise to evaluate. And I think the corporation has done a good job of maintaining the trust of Alaskans, and I hope we would not be judged by the view of maybe what other entities have done in violation of their procurement code potentially. So as I said, this is something that has been important to us for 4.5 years. We initially sought a full exemption from the procurement code, and with the feedback we got this last year, the first year of this session, we decided to pursue a modified version of it, which is why you'll see that this is for investment-related services and not a full exemption to the procurement code. So I want to make clear that that is not what this bill has in it that's before you.
Senator Wilikowski, follow-up.
Yeah, thank you. What sort of costs would you anticipate these contracts would amount to, and where do you how do you expect to pay for them? Would they come from the earnings of the Permanent Fund or the corpus?
Through the chair, they would come from our operating budget, which is funded by the earnings reserve account. And as for the amount of contracts, they could range anywhere depending on the length of time, anywhere from $20,000, $10,000 up to $100,000, $200,000.
So, thank you, Ms. Riddell. I would like to point out that in 1993, email was just emerging, and cell phones. A lot has changed since then. The investment market has grown exponentially, nationally and globally. The type of investments are much more sophisticated and much more competitive. There is money chasing after the best investors. Investors are not a dime a dozen. There are few good ones. And the key is to evaluate them and get into these investment vehicles pretty much over the long term. It is important to be able to respond relatively quickly and to give the permanent fund the flexibility to meet, I think Ms. Rodell mentioned it earlier, the incredible responsibility to provide 60% or more of the state revenue at this point. There is a precedent. I think we have public corporations already with the state of Alaska that have flexibility with the procurement. This is not something new. And with this fund being so big compared to most of the funds in the world today, there is a need to invest in many, many different vehicles in order to be diversified and to be thoughtful and deploy the money in a prudent way. So I don't think that what is being asked here is out of the norm. I think what we are asking the fund to do is to perform at its highest value, to provide the greatest good for the state of Alaska, and I think this is part of it. Senator, just for a moment, Senator Wilikowski, is there anybody else? So we'll do Senator Olson, then followed by Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Rodell, I can understand why you'd like to have the ability to go ahead and have more flexibility that's out there, but you've got to admit that under the current way the permanent fund investment operates, it's done very well, and any changes to that makes people uncomfortable about what's going on with the permanent fund. And how do we continue to have the public who calls in and says there seems to be an issue with the trust of Alaska in maintaining that with this administration in particular, because they seem to have a lot of these no-bid contracts that go to either supporters or people that have been involved in campaigns, and how do we make sure that the public trust is continued to be maintained in this, as was pointed out by the co-chair, this multi-billion dollar fund that's out there?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, I think you raise a really good point. And to be clear, this bill does not even go as far as the exemption provided to the Alaska Retirement Management Board. So the Retirement Management Board has more flexibility in procurement and adopting regs than we would receive with passage of this bill. So to be clear, we're not asking for something that hasn't been given to an investment management arm within the state of Alaska, and this bill doesn't ask for that. I think that unfortunately, what you raise is a really important topic of debate that we're having around the state, and we have to be able to trust our institutions. And I would hope that with the transparency with which the corporation has managed the permanent fund since its inception, allows us to recognize just how much we've done to earn Alaskans' trust. And when we are entrusted with making substantial investments, whether they be $1 million for a bond or $500 million for a private equity investment, that we stand tall and be worthy of a procurement exemption that would allow us to spend $50,000 to $200,000 to maybe up to $500,000 for investment-related services. And we're not suggesting that we do something outside the box and not document it, because we recognize that we're a public fund and we have to be held to a higher standard. So I do sympathize or empathize with the position, but I would hope that the corporation has earned the trust of Alaskans.
No further questions, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I just want to add that permanent fund meetings are open to the public. and the financials are available to the public. So we're going to have Senator Wilikowski followed by Senator Bishop.
Yeah. There's an exception already in the procurement code at 36, 38, 850, 15 for the Board of Trustees. It says a contract that is a delegation in whole or in part of investment powers or fiduciary duties of the Board of Trustees of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. What types of contracts will this section under this proposed bill encompass that the current section does not already cover?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, so those contracts that exemption exists for have a fiduciary responsibility associated with them. These are contracts where we need expertise. So for example, we are evaluating the purchase of an industrial building and we want an engineer to review and do due diligence on it. The engineer is not going to stand up and be a fiduciary and say that this is a good investment. What the engineer is going to say is that this is a sound building and you're not going to have to put in X number of dollars as a result. And so if it's a non-fiduciary, but it's investment related, we have to go through a standard procurement process today. And what we're asking for is exemption for that.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Senator Wilikowski asked part of my question. The other part of my question is along the lines on the analogy that you just described. Do you, if this bill was to pass as written, do you see yourself employing or contracting with some of these same people that you've already, that you've had experience with before, or is this new territory?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, it could be both. In some ways, we have investment advisors subcontract this work in order to meet the deadlines, and so this would allow us to directly contract and make a direct investment decision as opposed to relying on a third party investment decision. So we may go to people that we're familiar with their work in the past. And it could also involve the experts for investments we've never seen before and need a whole different level. And science is probably the biggest arena where this happens when there is an opportunity to invest, for example, in a biotech company and you want a third-party review of whether or not there's merit to the underlying science before you make that investment decision.
Thank you.
Ms. Riddell, does Alaska Housing Finance Corporation have something similar?
Madam Chair, Alaska Housing Finance Corporation has a full exemption from the state procurement code. They are just required to pass regulations.
Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. Can you just explain how these contracts would be issued? Would they be would it require a vote of the Board of Trustees? Would it just be the chairman or chairwoman of the Board of Trustees who makes the decision? Would you make the decision, the CEO? Would these decisions be made in a public hearing where the public would be aware immediately of the decision process that's occurring?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, this would have a process, and it would be decided internally by staff, and I would sign, the CEO, whoever the CEO is, would sign the contract.
To follow up with that, would there be any ability for the public to see the results of, let me phrase it this way, now, what's the process now that the public can see your decisions based on biotech underlying technology decisions or a building due diligence process?
Through Madam Chair, most of that is protected from under non-disclosure, because when you are evaluating an investment, you don't want to signal your interest necessarily too early because you want to be able to get the best price. You don't want to have a public bid and accidentally drive up the cost basis of an investment. And so most of that work is done under non-disclosure agreements. Also, it's protected under our public records exemptions.
Senator Wilikowski.
Just to clarify what I just heard, so that the public would not be aware of the experts that you would be hiring, or they would be aware of the experts and contracts that you would be issuing?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, I believe, but I don't, would need to check with legal. So I want to respect that I am not general counsel making this opinion, but my understanding is that these would be available under the public records request, that a member of the public could request our contracts and see who was awarded a contract and how much that contract was worth. But they would not necessarily see the work product of that contract.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is for the question for the Representative Johnston. As I read the bill, there's no sunset date on it. Is there ever consideration of doing something like that because of the magnitude of the amount of money that's in the permanent fund to see if it is a way to go?
Thank you, Senator Olson. I actually appreciate sunset dates, but this one I see no need. This is more the sophistication of the market and the sophistication of our fund. So I just feel that this is something we need to do to sort of catch up to 2020 as we expect more from our fund and more from our fund managers. By taking an approach of not taking this approach, we become more passive investors and we actually pay more out in management fees and we lose less of our upward investment opportunities because we have to have a third party in to do what we now have the sophistication to do ourselves. So I would not, to put a sunset to me would be going backwards, and I would not be in favor of it.
Madam Chair, if I can continue.
Senator Olson.
The flavor of the dialogue that I'm getting from you, though, is that it seems to be almost pessimistic about the return that's coming with the investment. While I look at the permanent fund as one of the premier investment strategies that's out there to give us such a good return, as was pointed out by the co-chair, 60% of the state's operating budget is now dependent on a permanent fund. If something is working, and being the conservative investor that I am, why would I want to change horses midstream and not have a second look at it at the prescribed sunset date?
Well, and this is, you know, your purview on your side of the in your body, but for me personally, I did not see a need because of that sophistication. We have been earning more, and probably one of our largest growth in funds was from private equity. And it's sophistication that has been developed in-house, and the fact that we now are a larger, more sophisticated fund, that more private equity opportunities come to the fund, and we might prefer, as we're growing the fund and to get more out of the investment, to hire our own consultants in science so that we don't have to share in the cost, first of all, with the manager, or, you know, share in the equity. So I see this as very optimistic. I see it's as our fund has grown, as I say, in its sophistication and what it's able to do. I mean, our fund is receiving international awards for our investments. So I just feel we're at the point that we need to take that next step. And it's not out of line with some of our other state corporations.
Last question, Madam Chair.
Senator Olson, follow-up.
Has to do with, you talked about the performance of the permanent fund and the investment, the return on it, et cetera. But I guess with the, and part of that has, and the private equity, part of it has to do with the stock market has taken off in an unprecedented amount that I've never seen in my whole lifetime. Now, I wasn't here during the 30s, as other people may be, but looking at that from that standpoint, don't you think there's going to be a correction of that, and and private equity is going to get a downfall?
You don't have, okay, please do not speculate on what you believe the stock market is going to do.
Right.
Okay, thank you. Senator Bishop.
Thank you. Ms. Rodell, how much money are we talking here? I mean, just as an estimate, I'm not going to hold you. Are we looking maybe at a $500,000 with these experts in the course of a year, or $1 million, or, I mean, you know, just as a range?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, I would expect this to be under $1 million over a fiscal year.
Okay, and we're letting you invest how many millions of dollars, billions that you're moving back and forth through the chair?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, we're at about $67.8 billion today.
Okay. One more follow-up.
Senator Bishop?
You know, right now, through the powers and duties of the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee, we have the ability to go in and look at any of those investments per our powers and duties as assigned by the Legislative Budget Audit Committee. But I do have a question for Leg's Legal at some point in time, if they're going to be before us today or in the future.
Okay, we can put the question to Leg's Legal at a different time, but I do appreciate you pointing out that Leg Budget and Audit does have the purview to look at a deeper dive in these type of situations. So thank you for pointing that out, Senator Bishop. And just real quickly before Senator Wilikowski asks this question, I just do want to say that it is of the highest and best use to meet the prudent investor rule to examine the underlying investments in any particular investment vehicle. If we're going to invest in a group of houses, let's go spot check some of the houses on the street and kick the tires. If we're going to invest in commercial buildings, let's go look at some of these commercial buildings. If we're going to invest in small hardware stores, let's go look and see these hardware stores and how are they being managed. That is the smart thing to do, to actually get the boots on the ground and walk into these buildings and actually touch them. A lot of times, Representative Johnson indicated that maybe some of the permanent fund employees can go travel around the globe and do these things, but sometimes it might make sense to get local partners that understand the real estate market. They're doing this now. We're just giving them a little bit more freedom to be able to work quickly, and again, it's less than $1 million. So, and it's certainly not out of the precedent with other public corporations that are doing this now. Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I certainly see the what you're trying to do and the benefits of what you're trying to do. On the other hand, you have $67 billion at your disposal and 14 billion dollars in the earnings reserve. Not that you would spend that entire amount, but there are no caps on what you could spend under this bill. If you decided you wanted to spend millions of dollars to hire a political supporter, there's nothing that anybody could do that could stop you once we pass this. And I'm not saying that you would, or not saying that anybody on the Board of Trustees would, but we have procurement laws in place for a reason. And if we're only talking about $1 million, would you support amending this to put a cap on how much you can spend, to say $500,000 or $1 million?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, to be very clear, we are going to be limited every year by our budget. So this is money that comes out of our operating budget. So our ability to spend millions and millions and millions of dollars without end under this is not the case. And this is a separate line item within our operating budget. So every year you will have the ability to go in and look at how much is being spent for this very purpose. And if the legislature is uncomfortable at any time with how much we're spending versus how much we're making, they can make their amendments through the budget process.
So I take it you don't have a problem with a cap if we put in, say, $1 million cap?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, I don't believe a cap is necessary, because by definition, you're going to have a cap in the budget process, and to have a cap in statute that can never be changed or amended or adjusted for inflation, I think is unnecessary. So no, I do not support a cap.
Would you support a provision that said you had to provide, do this in a public manner, or provide the information to the legislature of the contracts that you're providing?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, What I would suggest is if you want to amend the bill to give us a full procurement exemption similar to the ARM board that is then subject to regulations, passing regulations where we include this in regulations, I would fully support that.
I don't want to give you more power. I want to restrict.
So we have a bill in front of us. I think there's, let me see if there's anything, anybody signed up for public testimony, just to take a quick review here. We don't. So Senator Wilikowski, if you'd like to, we're not going to move this bill today. If you would like to, we can continue questioning, or if you'd like to spend some time just thinking about it. We're going to take a little bit of public testimony, see if there's anybody in the room. Then we will plan to set this bill aside. So at this time, I am going to open public testimony. Is anyone signed up online? Is anybody in the room? For public testimony, HB 139, Alaska Permanent Fund Procurement Exemption. Seeing no one signed up, public testimony is now closed. Okay. Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I think one of the things that might be nice to have for the public when we bring this bill back is maybe we could, the chairman could ask the vice chairman of the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee, who's sitting right next to me, to give the committee kind of an update on the powers of Legislative Budget and Audit. They're rarely spoken about in the public meetings, and they're very extensive, and in particular the oversight responsibilities of the permanent fund. And I think that should be wrapped up in this discussion for general information for all the members and the public to get a better view of the oversight structure that's currently in place. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. I think that's a good point. So at this time, we're going to set this bill aside and let my office know if you have any concerns or amendments. Thank you, Representative Johnson, and thank you, Ms. Rodell, and staff for being here today. So the next bill on the agenda is House Bill Number 68, an act relating to the Division of Labor Standards and Safety, relating to the Division of Workers' Compensation, establishing the Division of Worker Safety and Compensation relating to employment of a minor and providing for an effective date. Senate Finance has not heard this bill, but we did hear the Senate companion, Senate Bill 66, on April 4, 2019, and took public testimony. At this time, I would like to have the Department of Labor and Workforce Development remind the committee what this bill does and explain the differences between this bill and the Senate bill that was previously heard. So the commissioner had previously scheduled travel and cannot be here today, but we have Mr. Gray Mitchell, Director of Division of Workers' Compensation, and Mr. Joe Knowles. So please come to the table, thank you. Identify yourselves for the record and begin when you're ready.
Thank you, Chair Von Imhoff. My name is Gray Mitchell. I'm the Director of the Division of Workers' Compensation, and sitting next to me is Joseph Knowles. He is the Deputy Director of the Division of Labor Standards and Safety. As you may recall from last year, Senate Bill 66 is a division merger bill. That is the same core of House Bill 68. The bill does propose to merge the Division of Workers' Compensation with the Division of Labor Standards and Safety. As most of you know, labor standards and safety is primarily focused on preventing workplace accidents and enforcing laws related to workplace safety and wages, while the Division of Workers' Compensation is focused on the efficient administration of benefits to injured workers and enforcing laws related to workers' compensation requirements. The missions of these two divisions complement each other, in that one works to prevent the accidents and the other works to provide the efficient system for benefits to injured workers. The divisions have historically worked together, and this bill will increase those opportunities to coordinate operations and capitalize on efficiencies through a unified management structure. We have already begun the process, and the divisions are working together in coordination and have been over the past year. We are cognizant of the critical roles that each of these divisions have. The proposed merger does not impact any of the statutes or regulations currently administered and enforced by each division. We do intend to take advantage of position vacancies as they come available. We're not planning on making any, to look at the duties that are performed by those positions and try to coordinate and consolidate where it makes sense. One of the areas where we expect to see an efficiency is in flattening the management structure in labor standards and safety. And we have already reclassified the director position to a deputy director position, which will focus attention on operational aspects of the division's inspection, consultation, and enforcement functions, and will also supervise the investigation functions in the workers' compensation division. This will allow for a mid-level management reduction in the Alaska Occupational Safety and Health component. The chief position over that section will be subsumed by the deputy director position and then accommodated through a management restructure in the occupational safety and health component, which has already taken place. The prior fiscal note for Senate Bill 66 illustrated the opportunity to share administrative duties between the two divisions, and an office assistant to position was included in that fiscal note. This position, through our efforts over the last year to look at ways that we can streamline, has been eliminated in the governor's FY21 budget request. It has been vacant, and it is vacant. Those duties, so to give you an example of what we're doing, those duties will be backfilled by an office assistant position in the workers' compensation division in Fairbanks. And this is a wage and hour position in Fairbanks that's being deleted. The position that is in workers' compensation previously worked in the wage and hour component and so understands those programs and is able to basically walk across the hall and assist with reception and filing and all of those things that office assistants do. In addition to that, we're engaging in the Mature Alaskans Seeking Skills Training Program. And so we're using a masked employee, we call it, who's an older worker that's trying to gain re-entry into the workforce to allow them to have some opportunities for training. And it's interesting because the office assistant that we have in the workers' compensation program was a masked employee in the wage and hour program, then was hired permanently in the workers' compensation program, and now we're using a masked employee in wage and hour and that position to pull double duty between the workers' compensation division and the wage and hour office to make sure that those duties are maintained more efficiently. And we see that there could be future opportunities for increased efficiency. As our office lease spaces mature and expire, we will look to coordinate lease spaces. Of course, as I already mentioned, we'll look as positions come vacant to look at ways to coordinate and, again, streamline functions wherever we can. Amendments from the other body included several provisions, but singularly the concept is to reverse the division merger as of July 1st of 2022. We're not necessarily excited to come and pursue legislation in before 2022 to make these changes continue on, because it will be very difficult to try and unravel the two divisions once we've continued our efforts to coordinate them, if that's unsuccessful. But we can live with it. We would have rather been required to provide a report on the efficiencies created by the merger at some future point, and then if the legislature saw fit to pursue an action to pull the divisions back apart due to concerns about efficiencies or whatever concerns, losses of functionality, that could happen at that point. Another change in the other body involved a change in the allowable work hours for 14 and 15-year-olds during the summer months. Currently, from June 1st to Labor Day in Alaska, a 14 and 15-year-old can be employed between the hours of 5 a.m. and 9 p.m. A change would allow a 14 and 15-year-old to be employed from 7 a.m. to 10 p.m. So shortening the start time, but lengthening the end time. And this is to acknowledge Alaska's midnight sun daylight hours, and that a lot of young people in Alaska are out playing sports until 10 o'clock at night. And we need referees and people to assist with those things. And so this would extend that opportunity for those young workers to be employed. Another change would exempt businesses owned and operated by a grandparent from complying with Alaska's child labor laws when they're employing their grandchild in that business. There's currently an exemption for that for a parent owned and operated business. So this would extend that exemption for businesses owned and operated by the grandparents. The last change would eliminate work permit requirements for 16-year-olds. Alaska is currently one of just 17 states that has a work permit requirement for youth workers. The federal government does not require youth work permits. And at age 16, the rules for hours worked and duties performed are significantly reduced from what they are at the 14 and 15-year-old age group. So the need for a work permit is extremely diminished at age 16. This will allow us to have some efficiencies. About 85% of the 8,700 work permits processed in FY 2019 were for 16 and up year old minors. The process can be cumbersome. The current law requires written authorization from the commissioner and assigned consent from the minor's parent, which requires a piece of paper to make several rounds. The employer also has to sign off on it. And in general, it's viewed as an impediment to employment that we would like to reduce. The department is supportive of the adjustments to the child labor provisions, and it's our understanding that that these provisions will ultimately improve the efficiencies that could come from the division merger aspect as well. Because as these changes are made, we'll be able to again reevaluate the workloads and coordinate whenever possible as the two divisions come together. And so that's an explanation of the changes. I do have some points on the fiscal note, if that would be appropriate.
So thank you for that. I think we're just going to take a pause real quickly and accept questions. So real quickly before we go to Chair Stedman, you described the bill well. It seems to be that there's two parts. There's one part about merging the two departments, and then you talked a lot about other provisions, including grandparents and daylight hours. Why is a bill necessary to combine the two departments when you mentioned that it's already being done and successfully, I might add.
Chair Von Imhoff, the statutes currently have references to a director of labor standards and safety and a director of workers' compensation. And really, that's what the majority of the changes, the overwhelming majority of the changes do, is they simply change that name to either from the director of the Division of Workers' Compensation or the director of the Division of Labor Standards and Safety to the director of the new division, which would be the direct Division of Worker Safety and Compensation.
Okay, thank you. Senator Stedman.
I'm just kind of curious on any impact on the fishing industry with the changes in the child labor issue. And I'd also like to know, Madam Chairman, of all the permits, what industries are relying on the younger youth to work, and if you could help us with that.
Thank you.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, the changes will not affect the fishing industry. It's a surprise to many people, but I'm glad to announce it so that there is more clarity around this issue. But 14 and 15-year-olds are currently prohibited from working on a commercial fishing vessel unless that vessel is owned and operated by their parent. And so right now, you know, changing the hours for 14 and 15-year-olds will not have any impact on that. As far as the other question about the industries, the main industry that we see 14 and 15-year-olds employed in is the retail sector. They may be working in a grocery store, a tourism business, those kinds of things. But there are, you know, it runs the gamut. There's, you know, all kinds of opportunities for 14 and 15-year-olds. They are restricted in the types of activities they can perform. Simple things like getting on a ladder are prohibited. Operating a weed whacker with metal blades. There are all kinds of, things that we need to make sure are not being done by these workers because they have been found to be hazardous.
Chair Stedman.
Just for clarification, referencing under 16, the 14, 15-year-olds having to be employed on a fishing boat by their parents, could you give me a little more, clarity on that? Is it that strict, or does that include like your uncles or other fairly immediate family members that may own fishing vessels?
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, it is very strict. And it not only does the parent have to own the business, they have to operate it. So there are scenarios where the parent may own, let's say, three or four boats, but that boat that the 14 or 15-year-old or younger, if it's a business owned and operated by the parent, they could be any age. You could have an 8-year-old out there. But the parent has to be the one operating the boat.
Senator Olson has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. On the same point, when you talk about the parents being able to go ahead and have their children on board in Western Alaska, where commercial fishing is a big thing, many times we have grandparents that are raising the children. Are they included or not? I guess I'm concerned because you said it was a strict interpretation. Mm.
Through the chair, Senator Olson, they are currently not included, but under the proposed adjustment that would include grandparents under the exemption, they would be included in that exemption.
Madam Chair, if I could continue, so if I'm hearing you correctly, if there's a grandparent out there with a grandchild on board helping in the boat who's of that age, they would be violated.
Through the chair, that's correct.
Except this bill, to be clear, Senator Olson, I think, addresses that. Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. In just on Senator Stedman's question and Senator Olson's, I guess, how much ownership does a parent or grandparent need to have in order to be considered an owner? Is it 100%? Could they be like a 5% owner?
Interesting question, through the chair. The essentially the parent would have to be the primary owner.
So,
to be clear, that's 51% or more. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
And then just on the definition of operate, let's say it's a ship. The parent has to be operating. How do you define operating?
Through the chair, you know, I guess the example in terms of fishing would be that they were on the vessel, you know, controlling the operations of that fishing vessel. Now, would they have to be driving it at all times? I don't think that would, that's not what that would mean.
Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you. So, AS 2310-350 prohibits children under 18 from working in many dangerous jobs as well as in adult entertainment. Would this bill exempt grandparent-owned businesses from this protection?
Through the chair, the exemption that currently applies for parents for 14 and 15-year-olds applies to all of the child labor provisions. The exemption that we're expanding in this bill would exempt 14 and 15-year-olds from all of the requirements under the child labor provisions for a business owned and operated by the grandparent. The provisions that restrict, let's say, 16 and 17-year-old from working in an adult entertainment business are not subject to those changes because they're not part of that exemption necessarily.
So,
Senator Wilikowski,
I didn't really understand. So, could a child work in an adult entertainment business that their parent or grandparent owned?
You know, through the chair, I'd like to get back to you on that. It sounds like a question that we'd like to get the Department of Law involved in. I honestly don't have any experience where a parent is operating that type of business and trying to employ their children in it.
Different question, Madam Chair.
Okay. After this, we'll follow with Senator Bishop.
Okay. On the workers' compensation provision, in let's see, page 7, lines 15 through 17, it's just adding to the requirements or the powers of the director of the division and. To facilitate quick, efficient hearing, that language, line 15 through 17, is that does that have any legal meaning, or is it just simply codifying the already current goals?
Through the chair, this provision is currently under the authorities for the Division of Workers' Compensation. I don't have the exact statute memorized, but I believe it's 2330-001 or 2. And so this is combining the first five items. There are the current powers and duties of the Division of Labor Standards and Safety. And so paragraph 6 there adds the essentially the mission of the Workers' Compensation Division to that list and then combines it under the single name of the Division of Worker Safety and Compensation.
Thank you.
Senator Bishop, I believe you had a question.
Madam Chair, what's your next intentions for this bill? Are we going to go through a sectional? Because we've got a new section that's been added here today. It seems pretty straightforward, but I've got some line of questioning, and if you're going to do a sectional today, or I'll just wait till we get to that point. I don't want to be skipping around. And
so I think what we are definitely going to do is talk about the fiscal notes, because I believe that they have changed. We can go through a sectional, but you.
I mean, I'm just wanting to pay deference to the chair. If you don't mind, I'll just.
Ask your question now? Absolutely.
Okay. So, Mr. Mitchell, so can you give me, through the chair, could you give me an idea of, just for my own edification, the 2,000 permits that are approved now in the department for those 16 and up, you got a feel for what the, you know, the bulk of those are, what occupations those are in?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, so there was 8,700 work permit applications in fiscal year 2019. Of those, approximately 8,200 were approved. And those are in a variety of different industries. 16 and 17-year-olds, of course, can work in fish processing. They can work in retail grocery stores. They can work in restaurants. They can work in, shops. They're, let's say they might be working in an auto shop type of scenario. There are limitations on the types of tools that they can use, but there really is not, other than, as Senator Wilkowski was mentioning, with adult entertainment, there are not very many industries that are sort of just off limits.
Follow up?
Senator Bishop.
So we haven't changed anything. It's still 23 hours a week. We've adjusted for those that are going to school the start time from 7 a.m. versus 5 p.m., about 5 a.m.
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, so there's two standards for hourly limitations for 14 and 15-year-olds. One is for when school is in session, mm-hmm. and that's a 23-hour limitation per week. Then there's another limitation that applies during the summer months, which is 40 hours per week. And that standard will still apply. There will be an 8-hour per day, a maximum number of hours for 14 and 15-year-olds during the summer, and up to 40 hours per week.
Just my last question.
Senator Bishop.
So in school, we're changing the start time to 7 a.m.
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, that's correct.
And currently it's 5 a.m.
5 a.m. currently,
thank,
yes.
Thank you.
So before I get to Senator Wilkowski, I think what I'm hearing, and let me know if I'm summarizing this correctly, we're not making huge changes to the base labor rules for 13 and 14-year-olds or 15 and 16-year-olds. Essentially, we've opened it up where the hours are slightly different, to adjust for, you said, Little League games, among other things, and Midnight Sun during the summer, as well as adding grandparents to address what Senator Olson mentioned in his region in particular. This makes sense. The other part of the bill, of course, talks about merging these two departments in order to save money, which we should hear from you in just a moment when we start talking about the fiscal note. I think if senators here are interested in what the existing laws are, maybe you could provide us a chart that just shows us basic provisions of what existing laws, what industries they can work at, what does it mean to be ownership. Those are not changing, is my understanding. Is that correct?
That is correct.
So I think that the line of questions, we just have to be thoughtful about our line of questionings. If we want to learn more about what the existing laws are, we can do that outside of this session here. We need to talk about what the bill is doing and how it's changing, and I think you've been very clear on that. Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And just following up on that and Senator Bishop's question. And there's the other change, I guess, is just so we're doing the workers' comp labor standards is getting combined, and then you've got the changing the hours for and the ages for permits. And then the third thing is you're adding the grandparents and to the exemption. And I'm just curious about the exemption. And this goes to what Senator Bishop was asking. If a child's working for a parent or now under this bill a grandparent, is there a limitation on the number of hours they could work? Could they work 80 hours a week in a coal mine, for example? Or is there a prohibition against that somewhere?
Well, through the chair, Senator Stedman, the Alaska law, I'm sorry.
Get that all the time.
Senator Wilkowski. Sorry. The exemption, of course, is applicable to all of the restrictions under Alaska law. There are mirror provisions under federal law, and there is a similar exclusion under federal law, but it does not apply to the hazardous occupations. for a business that's owned and operated by the parent. So, for example, and we've had this scenario where a minor is employed by their parent and they're performing work that the state wage and hour staff identify as hazardous. We could not take action under our law, but we refer it to the federal wage and hour administration, and they correct that activity under their law.
So thank you. So thank you for being clear in terms of what the changes are and trying to tease that out of what existing law is and that it's not being changed. At this point, I would like to go through the fiscal note. It's my understanding that we have a fiscal note from last year, OMB component 970. I don't know if we have a new one for this year that addresses the sunset that you alluded to, as well as some of the changes. I think last year it showed maybe the full amount of the potential savings, and I think you've captured some of that savings already. So can you discuss, do we have a new fiscal note, and if we're still waiting for it, what might be on it?
Yes, Chair Von Imhoff. Apparently there was a glitch with the system that uploads the fiscal notes. We did submit them last week, but only one of them went through for the workers' compensation component, which shows a zero impact for the bill. Occupational safety and health component of the Labor Standards and Safety Division, and this is where the savings were shown in the previous fiscal note. We had a savings of $283,000 in the fiscal note for Senate Bill 66, which showed for the entire period from out through FY25. Due to the sunset, those savings would stop after fiscal year 2022. The adjusted amount is $199,500, which would be saved in fiscal year 2021 and fiscal year 2022. But this is associated with one position reduction, which is the chief of the occupational safety and health component. The previous $83,500 that was included in the fiscal note under Senate Bill 66 has been removed because that amount and the position associated with that amount is included in the governor's fiscal year 2021 budget request. And as I mentioned during my introductory remarks, that is an office assistant to position in Fairbanks that has been combined between the divisions of workers' compensation and divisions of labor standards and safety, along with this masked employee to cover the workload. Does that?
I think that's very clear. Thank you very much. And I do commend the administration for already undergoing this and experiencing efficiencies and cost savings. And while we're not necessarily talking about millions of dollars, I'm very pleased to see any savings. And to me, I have a motto is savings by 1,000 cuts. So no savings is too small. And really, inefficiency is kind of like fat in a piece of meat. It's marbled throughout the entire enterprise. I think slashing millions of dollars, tens of millions of dollars is very, very difficult. But the approach that you're doing is thoughtful and strategic and focused, and we'd like to say thank you. So I know Senator Bishop had a comment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll reserve my comments on the fiscal note till I see the updated fiscal note to see the difference between DGF, UGF, WISCA funds, how the fund sources works on this savings. And the last thing I'll just say on this, the reason I support the sunset is having been there and know this workload. Now, this guy might be able to handle the workload, but I'm not so sure that the next guy that comes behind him can handle the workload between those two divisions. So that's why I support the sunset. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you. And I guess while we're on the topic of savings, I have another bill that would repeal the Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission, which would save another $426,000 per year. And that's passed the House a couple of years ago, 40-zip. Would you support an amendment to include that in this bill?
Through the chair, Senator Walikowski, I don't have an answer to that right now. I'd need to consult with department leadership on that.
So we don't have any plans to move this bill today. We are going to set it aside. Is there any further questions by the committee? Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm still a little bit concerned on the absolute, you know, the addition of the grandparent, I agree with. I'm not so sure it shouldn't be more inclusive to include your uncles or your aunts. Mainly, I think my number of people would be your uncles, because on occasion there is no grandparents, but there is uncles that have particularly fishing vessels, and there are young Alaskans that have less opportunity in their home environment, and having the ability to get them out from under that and have them out, you know, working a little bit and seeing a little different lifestyle is good for them. And I know some of this stuff goes on, and I'm just think that we should think about that a little bit and consider that expansion, even if they have to jump through a few extra hoops to do it, so we don't close that door. And I know personally several examples where that's come into play, where it's been the uncles that have stepped in to deal with some of the youth to try to get them, I don't want to say really like turned around, but show them a different lifestyle.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I want to echo the support I have for the concern that Senator Stedman just voiced, because where we have places that have got limited entry permits that are valuable to people, especially for some reason the fellow that owns it, but it's owned by the family, is are able to go ahead and be used or leased out to the immediate family members that they have, with, as was talked about, uncles, and I want to include aunts in that as well, because my sister was a commercial fisherman for a long period of time, and so I want to just support what Senator Stedman has been pointing out.
Thank you. If there's no further questions, we thank the presenters here for being here today. We will need to update the effective dates and previously received amendments to the Senate bill. And my staff will check with the committee members to see if these amendments are still necessary, if there's other concerns. So we're going to take House Bill 68 and set aside at this time. So that concludes today's meeting. Tomorrow, we will start the initial presentation of SB 52, the Alcohol Beverage Control, Alcohol Regulations, also known as Title IV Rewrite. Get ready, hold on to your seats. This is the big one. We will not be taking public testimony or considering amendments at tomorrow's meeting. We're just going to be hearing the bill because it's a big one. And with that, we are adjourned.